We'll do it live!
You are listening to the AMC Report with your host, Ryan Dawson.
All right, this is the Anti-Neocon Report. I'm Ryan Dawson. My guest today is Thomas Goodrich, or Michael Goodrich as he goes by sometimes. You know, I get all the black sheep on this program, and this guest is no exception. He's written a number of books, historical books. He's a historian. He's been a writer for 25 or 26 years, and he's written about everything from the Indian Wars, Abraham Lincoln, what happened to the South post-Civil War, and he's written about World War II, and that's going to be the topic today. He wrote a book, which is now also a film, called Hellstorm, and it is about what happened, mostly what happened to Germany at the end of the war and after the war, as more Germans were killed in peacetime than actually during the war. Now, this is not to exonerate anything that Nazi Germany did or any crimes like that. This is just basically to point out how equally horrific crimes were done by the Allied powers as well, to wipe away a little bit of this American exceptionalism. And I got a small rant, and I'm going to bring them right in. But I just would like to say, you know, people sometimes they say, are you a Holocaust denier or something like that? Anybody that tries to revisit World War II gets painted like they're a crazy Nazi. And Nazi, of course, in our lexicon is the epitome of evil. I don't deny Holocaust, plural. The problem is I also acknowledge the Holocaust of Hamburg, of Dresden, of Frankfurt, of Nagoya, of Tokyo, of Kobe, and the murder of millions in Vietnam and North Korea, Iraq, the Congo, etc., and the colonization of the Americas, the Oceanic States, and much of Africa, and the tens of millions who starved to death or were worked to death under communist China and the USSR. And yes, the Axis raped and murdered and imprisoned people, but about 1/100th as much as the Allies countries have done and have done for centuries and continue to do today. And Japan and Germany have not fired a shot in 75 years, so maybe if we understood the horrors and atrocities of France and the United Kingdom, America and Russia, we wouldn't be so much hell-bent on death and destruction today. Instead of the word Nazi being the epitome of evil, as it's become the state religion, why not the word colonizer? Colonization continues today. The Israelis do it openly, ethnically cleansing Palestinians, and yet the stigma is not there. It's only there when you lose a war. The winners write the history, and that's why I think this book and this film, Hellstorm, are so important, because revisionism and World War II is one of the most important topics in politics today and history today. We cannot allow the winners to write the history. We have to have history from the losing side, because World War II is used to justify every war after it. And that's why my guest today is taking, and he's going to get a lot of flack. I'm sure he's got a lot of flack for writing about what he's written about. He has done the task of digging up and talking to eyewitnesses and giving their accounts and giving the report about what happened to Germany, the side we never hear. Thomas Goodrich, welcome to the program. It's good to talk to you. I'm excited about this. Sorry for the long introduction.
No, Rye, thanks so much for having me, and thanks a million for that beautiful introduction. I wish I had written it myself. It sort of sets the table, doesn't it, for our talk?
Yeah, well, I had to say et cetera because I couldn't even name all the cities that were burned down or countries that had been invaded.
That's true. It's so true. And I'm glad you also pointed out something. This is not about the Holocaust, folks. If you want to learn all about the Holocaust or the winner's version of World War II, just visit any library, watch any World War II documentary on TV, read any article, any newspaper on
World War II. There are museums for it.
And museums, and you're going to get the official narrative, that is the winner's narrative on the good war, so-called good war. This is not about that. We're talking, this is not about what the Germans did to the world, the book and the movie and our talk today. It's not about what the evil Nazis did to the world. It's about what the world did to the Germans. This is the first book and the first movie that's devoted to nothing but what the losers saw. Their version of losing this war. And that's what it's about. It's about the darkest and best kept secret in world history, by the way. Never in history have so many people been murdered. Never in history have so many people been raped. Never in history have so many people been tortured. Never in history have so many people been enslaved. And yet never in history have so few people known about this. That's what we're talking about here today. It's about so many crimes that it's a little bit like Ryan talking about, et cetera. Yeah, okay. Allied terror bombing, firebombing of German cities and Japanese cities also. But that's one of many crimes we talk about. So I'll just say et cetera. And perhaps we'll have time to talk about some of these.
I think it's vital, too, though, in that is the language is very important. And how it's written in Hellstorm, I won't say poetic, but very detailed and graphic. And that is absolutely vital because too often today, especially on televised media, they control the lexicon and they use things in terms of just statistics and numbers. So if I said 2 million people were killed in Vietnam, all right, that is a fact. Millions of people were murdered in Vietnam. That's not considered a Holocaust, though. It's considered a police action. And it's just, oh, yeah, well, whatever. That was a bad war. So millions. But you don't get the effect because we're not seeing the museum full of hair and shoes and pictures of dead bodies and things like we do for what the Nazis are accused of doing. The film isn't there. The emotion isn't there. The details aren't there. But in Hellstorm, people have heard that Dresden was bombed, probably more so than other cities. And they go, oh, yeah, that was bad. But I don't think they have their head around it completely. And it is necessary, I believe, to have the graphic details of how people were burned alive, raped, tortured, etc. It's necessary to kind of break that mental shield, because we too often talk about wars and deaths in terms of numbers, and we're not really humanizing the people and the victims. And I think I'd actually like you to, I know it's hard to do, but if you can describe a little bit what happened to people in German cities with the RAF bombers and the American bombers, what it was like on the ground.
Okay, let me first preface with what I'm going to say with this about the nature of the book, how the book was actually created. This book is a first-person you-are-there approach. It's immediate, it's timely, it's hopefully up close and personal. It's deliberate, too, also. I will say that because I knew I would take a lot of flack, a lot of criticism from the usual suspects. And I know how easy it is to kill the messenger. It happens to anybody like myself who tries to postulate with a contra narrative. And so I thought it was very important to allow the people to do as much talking in this book as possible. And the movie that Kyle Hunt has made that mirrors, adheres almost word by word to the book itself. It's important because you might kill me, the messenger, or Kyle Hunt, the filmmaker, but it's almost impossible to kill the message when it's in the words of the people themselves, in the words of people who suffered through the Allied terror bombings, not saturation bombings, not carpet bombings, not area bombings, terror bombings. That's what the people below called it, terror bombing. A deliberate attempt to kill.
It's also the collective punishment of the people for what the government's doing.
Yes, it's a deliberate attempt to kill every man, woman, and child down below through bombing raids, through firestorms. It's a deliberate attempt. Late in the war is when I begin. The subtitle of the book is The Death of Nazi Germany, 1944 to 1947. 44 to 45, of course, that's 1 year of war left. By 1944, there were very few military targets left in Germany. And certainly the cities had been bombed until they were just a shell. You've seen the pictures of the cities, what they look like. So these continued terror bombing raids are for no other higher purpose than just to kill as many refugees and as many women and children as they possibly can.
Well, Churchill had a plan to actually drop poison gas to wipe out even the remainder that he hadn't been able to burn to death. He wanted to poison them with gas. And I think the only reason he was talked out of it is that the Germans had their own chemical weapons that could have been dropped on English cities.
Yes.
That was something he wanted to do.
Yes, and you're right. To my knowledge, there was no poison gas in World War II used anywhere. And no thanks to the Allies, because, yes, Truman, I'm sure FDR would have signed on to that immediately. His Jewish advisors would have been happy to drop atom bombs on Germany. Fortunately, they weren't ready by that time, and Japan paid the price for that. But nevertheless, all of this didn't stop the American 8th Air Force from bombing neutral Switzerland. Basel, Zurich, other towns in Switzerland were bombed by Americans. I guess it was an attempt to widen the war. They didn't give a damn. They knew they were going to win the war this late stage of World War II, and so they could do whatever they wanted. That's the clear message. In fact, one time I actually was at a book signing here in Florida, and a gentleman came up, bought a book, but he told me that his home in Switzerland had actually been destroyed by American airplanes. So, but anyway.
They're just chasing refugees. I mean, it was to wipe out the Germans. You had the Baltic Sea Massacre. I mean, that just chasing refugees. But before we get in, that's a whole other topic, the Baltic Sea Massacre. I want to mm-hmm. ask you that in detail, but relay some of these stories, you know, like the father and son going to the business to see if anything was remained. People need to hear how disgusting war actually is because they've been desensitized to it. They just don't, I don't think they fully understand, unless they've been in a war, like at all, how horrible it is. And most of the world experienced a war and never wanted another one, but the U.S. didn't lose any cities, didn't experience that. You know, some of the people coming home were over it, didn't want to talk about it, but you get a whole crop of basically the America fuck yeah crowd who is these jack-off missile Johnny Glass parking lot types who are demonizing the Muslims like as if they were the Nazis today and want to murder. If you could talk about some of the stories you heard from these witnesses in German cities, I think that would be very pertinent and useful for people to hear.
Let me first lay out what a terror bombing raid was like in the later stages of the war, 1944 to 1945. Essentially, it worked like this. In fact, let's use Hamburg as an example, 1943. Hamburg had remained relatively unscathed in the first 3 years of war. A lot of folks surmised in Hamburg, that is, that the American and British left Hamburg alone, which is the second largest city in Germany, because it was the most English of all German cities, or because Churchill's aunt lived in Hamburg. They speculated on a lot of reasons, but I think they found out clearly why Hamburg had been left alone on a summer night in 1943. That's when the RAF came in with 1,000 bombers and blew this otherwise untouched town to atoms, blew it to smithereens. Just virtually extirpated Hamburg from the face of the earth. And when the people finally came out, the ones who survived, that is, from their holes and saw the smoking city all around them, of course, they realized that it had been used as a test to see how devastating this raid could be. What the people didn't realize, however, was that this was just one half of the bombing raid. A few hours later, in came another 1,000 planes. And when the people finally ran back and got into their air raid shelters again, the planes above started dropping bombs again, but these weren't high explosive bombs. These were incendiary bombs. These were phosphorus bombs that ignited once they came down and contacted with the splinters, with the kindling that was Hamburg. After the first bombing raid, everything was blown to bits, including the old wooden structures in the old city. And so these fire bombs ignited this kindling, the wood. And of course, the people who went back into their refuge into their shelters, that's the worst thing they could have done, because these havens now became ovens. The fires caught, and in a matter of minutes, that's the description, in a matter of minutes, the fires joined and started creating this intense heat right in the center of the city, a heat so intense, some speculated that it was between 1,500 and 3,000 degrees. Heat so intense that the copper roofs melted on the people who were trying to escape. Heat so intense that it actually created a vortex, a flame, a fiery tornado, if you will, that went 3 miles in the sky, according to some accounts. Now, a tremendous amount of heat like that in the center draws in incredible cool air from the outside, so strong, so forceful that it was compared to a hurricane, the winds being sucked in to feed this furnace. And this, of course, tore roofs off buildings, knocked over trolley cars and automobiles and sucked them into the center. It also, unfortunately, sucked in people. People were sucked in screaming into the middle of this fiery tornado. Those who weren't sucked in generally were those who became mired in the melting asphalt. And, of course, the screams were very quick and over, and that people burst into flames. That is, in essence, a terror raid, a firestorm created. And Dresden was the most noteworthy. I think most of your listeners are aware of Dresden in February of 1945. But let me say this. All German cities suffered the fate similar to Hamburg and Dresden. Berlin, Munich, Mannheim, Würzburg, Cologne, Düsseldorf, it go on and on. All cities in Germany suffered firestorms, even smaller cities. In fact, one of the smaller cities, I think it's Pforzheim, a city of roughly 50,000 people, was firebombed one night after Dresden and suffered 30,000 deaths.
The body count on a lot of these are lower than what it ought to be, because often in such a fire, yes, there aren't any bodies.
Exactly. Dresden is the most egregious and criminal and special, I must say, firestorm raid. Nothing that mankind has done to man comes close to equaling what happened in Dresden. Dresden suffered the same fate as Hamburg. I just described what happens there. Plus Dresden.
Some of the people in Dresden were refugees from the other cities that were firebombed, and they got firebombed twice.
Half people in Dresden that night, February 14th, were refugees, mostly women, children, and old people, fleeing the Red Army to the east. Dresden, a city of roughly 500 to 600,000 people, was doubled by that night by roughly 500 to 600,000 refugees with nothing, virtually nothing, and certainly no records. But Dresden went through the same cycle that I mentioned with Hamburg, with the exception that it was treated virtually the same way for the next week. In other words, the people who did survive the firestorm of Dresden found shelter in the huge central park and along the banks of the Elbe River, which Dresden had been called the Florence on the Elbe. It was a magnificent world treasure. And this also made the Allies especially evil and hateful of the city, because that's a great way to get rid of a beautiful Germanic city. But the people who sought refuge the following day in the parks and along the river, they had to experience American strafing. American fighter pilots came in on a very clear day and just started killing the people. It was a massacre of thousands and thousands of people. American pilots could see who they were shooting. There was no question about it. They chased them down, shot them with machine gun and cannons. Even zoo animals that had miraculously escaped the two previous bombings were shot by these American heroes. In fact, one zookeeper cried when he saw an American in a Mustang fighter plane chase down his last giraffe and shoot it full of holes. This went on for about a week, killing everything that's in Dresden or coming into Dresden to try to rescue. And it's estimated about 2 weeks later, the International Red Cross estimated that it was around 250,000 was the total they came up with. That's the International Red Cross from Switzerland came there and took numbers. And about a month after that, the German bureaucrats, and we all know how thorough and how much Germans like to count beans and keep records and things like that. They came down and they estimated anywhere from about 200,000 to 400,000 died in Dresden, terror bombing of Dresden. What that means is, and I accept those numbers, by the way, that's the numbers I'm coming up with, too. I don't come up with the numbers that the modern day so-called historians and experts in Germany, which aren't Germans at all, say that 25,000 to 35,000 at most died in Dresden. That's a lie, and they know it.
The whole city was decimated. I mean,
yes, what they're trying to do, they figure that if they can diminish the number of deaths, they can diminish the crime itself. Well, this doesn't work. It doesn't work. I trust people back then on the site. The thing is, what most people are missing here is that thousands, tens of thousands, maybe even hundreds of thousands, I'm not sure, of people in Dresden that night were refugees, and they had no records whatsoever. These people are simply gone. No records, no addresses. And you could put together the atomic bombings of Nagasaki and Hiroshima combined, and they still do not equal the firebombing of Dresden on one night.
Well, I'd argue that those numbers were played down too, though.
On Nagasaki and Hiroshima?
Yeah.
Probably.
I think a lot more people died than what is admitted.
And would you not, Ryan, also admit that that's probably an attempt to diminish the crime?
Oh, of course, it's what it is. Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, there are exaggerations in both directions. They'll say the Germans killed more than they actually did, and they say the Allies killed fewer than they actually did. I mean, that's the benefit of winning a war. But, yeah, absolutely. And I think it's really hard to determine numbers, too, when you just burn everything. These are civilian cities. You shouldn't be burning them at all. Even if they were empty, it's still a crime. They are not military targets. They were just ethnically cleansing Germans and punishing. Dresden wasn't even an industrial center either. I mean, they're just blowing it up.
Right. And it wasn't protected. Dresden had gone throughout the war without any significant bombing raid. So the guns, the anti-aircraft weapons that protected many or most German cities were taken elsewhere, needed elsewhere. And so we have a virtually unprotected town. It's also known as a refugee city, as we've mentioned. It's also known as a hospital city because it was one of the few places in Germany where people could come and recuperate, not just the soldiers, but other people with diseases and cancers and things like that. So it was all those things, and it was the special animus of the Allies to attack and destroy. It was also Stalin's request. The big three criminals, Stalin, Roosevelt, and Churchill, had met in Yalta to wrap everything up. We're getting close to winning the war. They knew that. They decided to carve up the Turkey, and that was giving Stalin all of Eastern Europe, basically, and including Berlin. But Stalin also demanded from Churchill and Roosevelt, his willing dupes. And by the way, they were. They were, man, I think if Stalin had said, get down on your knees and service me, I think they would have. That's how desperate these creatures were. Roosevelt in America, Churchill in England. But Stalin demanded they do something major, do something horrific to Germany, to draw away some of the German soldiers that were fighting his men on the East Front, still fighting tooth and nail, by the way. And so Dresden was their gift to Stalin, basically. This probably the greatest war crime in world history. Now, this movie talks about a lot of major war crimes, so it's very difficult at times to determine which is the most beastly and abominable crime committed by the Allies. You put them all together, nothing ever occurred in Earth history that would come or equate to what the Allies did to the Germans during and after the war. Nothing comes close. I'm a student of history just like you are, Rye. No, you can look in vain for the rest of your life, and you'll never find anything like this. We're just talking about one component.
Well, the other thing, too, is the other atrocities in history, usually after a certain amount of time, they are vilified. People at least admit it was wrong, that it was done. Mm-hmm. But they don't even admit that this was done.
Mm-hmm.
Historians agree about Dresden and everything, but it's not your school textbook, if you know what I'm saying. Like, you just hear the other side. You do not hear the mass amount of rape that happened, especially from the Soviet Union and some of the Mongolian hordes that came in raping people to death. Sorry. And, you know, rape as murder, you know, shoving broom handles up German women's vaginas and every other objects and gutting people and sawing people in half and... Yeah, it kind of...
Well, I'll tell you what, we'll talk about that in just a second. You're right, though. It's been 70 years. The crimes we're talking about and the crimes we will talk about, no, nobody really knows about this. 70 years. Now, this, what you hear, what I'm going to tell you, I think it'll convince you by the time we're through, is the greatest, by far, war crimes ever to occur. But you know, there's a crime within a crime here. 70 years under a mountain of lies, hate, envy. All of this has been buried for 70 years. That's a crime too. That's a world crime, if you ask me. Why is it a crime? Because you're right. We need to know both sides of the war, because that old saying, it still holds true about if you do not learn from your history, you're doomed to repeat it. I will add that if you do not even have a history, you're never going to learn from it. And so you're going to repeat it. And that's exactly what we're doing right now in the Middle East. And probably, unless we get a grip, what's going to happen with us in Russia. That is us. I'm talking about the West and Russia fighting it out with World War III.
Well, I mean, the World War II was the worst war in history.
Absolutely.
And, you know, around 65 million people died, conservatively. Well, I'm including the communist deaths in China and Russia. That is just unfathomable. And yet, World War II is constantly used to justify the next new war. And they call Saddam Hussein's the new Hitler. Vladimir Putin's the new Hitler. Ahmadinejad's the new Hitler. You get these from these neocons like Gary Schmidt and Robert Kagan and these fools, and these chicken hawks that are like, Hitler, Hitler, Hitler. That is the go-to example. If even in college, if you want to give an example of something evil, it's the Nazis. It's the new state religion. It's
yes.
Nazis. I mean,
and any attempt at peace, reconciliation between the two sides, between Russia and Iran and America, any attempt is always called Munich. It's called basically, in other words, they equate it with Munich and acquiescence, that if we don't stop this new Hitler now or this new Third Reich, yes, we're basically setting ourselves up for an even worse fall. It's the same.
World War One's what set up World War II. But what I don't understand is the psychology of how can these colonial empires get a pass? You know, when the British and French killed about 44 million Africans, the colonization of the United States, the millions killed in Vietnam, millions killed in North Korea, over a million killed recently in Iraq. That's since 2003. The rampant starvation, etc. Our government has killed millions of people after World War II, and still doesn't receive the stigma and the association with evil for the wars after. Not even what they did to the Germans, but what they've done to Indochina and all these other places, murdering millions of people, and yet still walk around the world stage as the good guys and humanitarians and so on. It blows my mind.
Well, when you control the media, as the Jewish power grid has for the last 100 years, you're going to control people's thoughts, more or less. You're going to control what your governments do. And that's been the case ever since World War II, well, from World War I all the way up to now. But it's changing. It's changing rapidly. In fact, the fact that you and I are talking here, the fact that we're sharing or we're bridging continents, you in Asia, me in North America, that shows that the dynamics are changing. But you're right. It's easy to continue the same old when you own the presses, when you own the TVs, when you own the radios, because that's, after all, the only thing our parents and grandparents had to go on. So they were easy to control.
I understand what you're saying there if you want to talk about something like the Israeli colonization of Palestine, where nobody on TV or even a newspaper will admit that there's a military occupation, that they build Jewish-only cities and bulldoze down houses and kill Palestinians and occupy the land. They act like there's settlements and neighborhoods and Israel's on the defense and blah, blah, blah.
Mm-hmm,
but
sure.
Some of these other things, like the war in Vietnam, which also attacked Laos and Cambodia, are known. Like, that's already, people know millions of people were killed. And it's still like, yeah, whatever. It's not even hidden, some of this stuff, from the media, and because it doesn't involve the Zionists. They'll go ahead and admit how many people died in Asia. It doesn't really, you know, affect them so much. But, you know, obviously with Israel, that's how it is. That's, you know, we wouldn't have sanctions on Iran. We would not have gone to war in Iraq. We wouldn't be involved in Syria if it weren't for the Israeli lobby. But there are still some crimes that everyone knows the British and French colonized like half the planet. And it all gets a pass. It's like, oh, well, that was a long time ago. It's like, no, it isn't. I'm talking about wars that happened after World War II, like the last 70 years, the millions of people that the Allied powers have continued to butcher. The Russians killed about 1.7 million people in Afghanistan in the 80s. That's a lot of people for such a small country. I don't know how many the Americans have killed, but we're set to be there till 2024. And it's as if their lives don't even matter, just like the Germans. And that's why I think if you could start, you know, from the not the beginning yet, but, you know, from World War II on, and understand the victims of that war, then you could understand the victims of the wars after and the wars that are currently happening now.
You know, let me say this. First of all, when I get off the book and the subject of the book, I'm mostly shooting from the hip. I'm not an expert. I'm not even an expert on my own life, much less other histories. Let me say this, and let me offer this. We live in a highly militarized society, and that goes for most Western nations, but America is preeminently a welfare warfare state. That's how we exist. That's our sustenance. We have become so numbed to the nonstop wars. And basically, it's been a continuum ever since ever since the Spanish-American War. It's been a continuum of American aggression, American occupation, American slaughter. And you can deny it all you want, but the stats really don't lie on this one. We have been almost always engaged in a war somewhere or some sort of, quote, police action. Now, let's put it this way. Sometimes they're hard to keep track of. You'd almost have to keep scorecard. And eventually people say, well, what the fuck? I mean, why? Vietnam, that's ancient history. Or Grenada, or attacking Panama, or Honduras. It's nothing to them, even though, as you mentioned, thousands, even hundreds of thousands are killed.
And the number eventually, of CIA assassinations and other incursions and things.
Absolutely. Well, going on with Iran and other countries right now, this low-grade warfare against them. Eventually,
the banking, even IMF's intentional perpetual debt and starvation rampant around the third world. That is on purpose.
It's going to take bigger people probably than Ry Dawson and Tom Goodrich to actually focus on one war and say, this was truly terrible, folks. Do you remember what happened? Because let's face it, Ryan, there's always more wars coming. And to really focus upon any war, what can I say? No wonder most people don't give a damn. I'm talking about Americans right now. Because I'm familiar with Americans. Of course they don't give a damn. I mean, but honestly, how in the hell could they give a damn? There's so many wars to choose from. And we've got so many coming up. Even these creatures, these neocon monsters, this mafia that runs this country right now, they admit that this is probably going to last your lifetime, and maybe even your kid's lifetime. It's a nonstop war. Damn, they come right out and tell us that.
They openly have aided Al-Qaeda, the Mujahideen, Jandala,
they create the wars. You're right.
Like all these covert mercenaries, these proxy forces, they write policy papers boasting about it. They say, well, it's good for business. You know, let's keep these two sides fighting each other on low-level controlled conflict to keep that whole revolving door spinning in a circle with the military-industrial complex. That's the other result of World War II, was that, you know, as wars became more and more mechanized and used more and more expensive machines, planes, tanks, and so on, it created a new kind of industry. This isn't like the guys with guns on a horse. It became extremely expensive to wage modern warfare in the mechanized era. And it's now worth hundreds of billions of dollars. And when we talk about the welfare warfare state, the majority, almost 90% of the welfare is corporate welfare. And it's most of the corporate welfare is involved in military industries. And half the shit they make doesn't even work. I mean, they build things for the sake of it, just to involve as many industries as possible, because it's, you know, the government redistributing wealth to itself to murder other people in another place. I mean, it's the worst thing in the world, but you're not allowed to take a real good analytical look at any of it, because to question what was done in World War II, the excessive deaths, defeats, the nuclear blasting, etc., is to be equated with you'll be a racist and a Nazi and everything evil, when really it's just somebody trying to advocate peace. Say, well, is it really necessary to murder millions of people and to starve people to death? Of course it isn't, but you'll be labeled as evil if you stick up for Palestinians. They think you hate Jews, but well, couldn't I just not support genocide because it's wrong? I mean, it doesn't have to do anything with ethnicities or or religions or anything. It's just morally abhorrent to bulldoze down someone's house and shoot their children. I mean, that is a fact of what is happening, and yet it happens openly, and our media ignores it on purpose.
Yeah, I suppose I've crossed the line. I suppose this is what homosexuals felt like when they came out of the closet. They felt this sudden release, this euphoria, this freedom. Words don't bother me anymore. People can call me virtually anything they want, and it's just not going to stop me. It won't deter me. It's not going to abate. I'm not going to give up. I'm going to continue. And they can call me anything they want.
I'm just saying that the words are effective because
sure,
professors have been fired. People lose their jobs. It can affect your life tremendously. I think that's why a lot of businessmen and people don't even bother talking about subjects they know well and good about, because you will pay a real price just for your political opinion or historical opinion on World War II. It is the most taboo subject there is.
Let me say this.
More than religion, more than anything.
It's let me say World this. War II. Yeah, right. This is a development that you might find interesting. I get emails virtually every day, and occasionally they're really revelational emails. I cannot tell you how many individuals have emailed me recently in the last year or so, and these people are crossing the line. They realize that the ground they're standing on is shrinking, and we're talking about movers and shakers. We're talking about leaders in their professions. I won't reveal any professions because it may get very close to revealing who the people are. But let me say this. I will reveal one profession. And the other day I got an email from an individual who is a high functionary in the EU, the European Union, encouraging me to continue. Now, here's the person that is locked into the system, but who knows the system is rotten. And these people are starting to commit because their instincts are kicking in. They realize the time is short. World War III could be breaking out as we speak right now, for all we know. And there's not going to be much time to worry about your jobs or security if World War III and nuclear Armageddon comes down on us. And so I think people are realizing that jobs, peer pressure, these are secondary to survival. And if we don't do something pretty damn quick, we may not be surviving. And I think that's what this is all about. It's like animals during a tsunami. You can watch animals and they'll head for high ground before the humans will. And I think that's what's happening right now is people are actually coming over and they're basically going to work. And I think that's what's happening. At least it is in my situation. You know, here in America, you know, we've got sports up the wazoo, college sports, especially college football. Some of these universities are really basically just large football programs with a small college attached. And I think that's also the case with America. With America right now is it's a small, rotting, soon-to-be third-world nation with an enormous military component attached to it. In other words, we're attached to the military machine right now. It's not the other way around. Otherwise, you wouldn't be paying taxes on taxes. That's what's going on right now. A tax for this, a tax for that, on and on and on. You've got to fund this military monster that we've got. And that's what's happening. And it's rotting us out entirely. We don't, you know, it's rare to find an American who actually believes in this country, other than your stupid sports fan who shops at Walmart and hangs out his flag patriotically.
Wall Martians, yeah.
Yeah. And so, no, talk to any semi-intelligent, studious American, and you say something stupid to them about great that we're winning someplace like that, and they'll look at you like you're nuts. Because we have lost faith in this country. And that's exactly what I mean by a rotting third world nation.
Like you said earlier, because just for a quick example, the second war in Iraq, millions of people protested the war, and the only ones to cover it were C-SPAN. I mean, not a single channel. I was there, one of them in New York City.
You're the second person to tell me that in 2 days, by the way.
Well, it's true, because people at the protest were looking forward to the coverage on TV, and people were like, what protest? I mean, if you weren't in one of those cities, you would not have known that even happened. There were protests around the entire world, and they got coverage, except for the ones in American cities.
You know,
only C-SPAN covered it.
And we're back to your title for your show, this anti-neocon approach. You know, the same mobs. Well, I remember Vietnam. I was in the military at the time. I'm that old. Every night it was evening news, thousands of people marching in the streets against the Vietnam War. It got all the coverage it could possibly handle. Now we've got these neocons, the same individuals who are marching in the streets against the war in Vietnam, about a war, in theory at least, against communism. Now the same people, their sons and daughters, of course, or grandsons and granddaughters, are the ones that are most avaricious for war in the Middle East. Does anybody put these two things together? Do they understand? It was basically Jewish leadership in the Vietnam period, the protest, that is. And now we've got the same individuals, or their daughters and granddaughters, who are basically the loudest cheerleaders for war in the Middle East against Muslims when it benefits Israel. Do you see I hope the listeners understand this. It's really not very difficult to understand. Maybe I'm getting off on the subject here. I get a good, great host like you, Ryan.
Well, I'm going to bring it back to the rape stories. It's not that I'm looking forward to talking about that, but I think it's necessary. But I think, you know, with Vietnam, is where they learned, all right, we better control the press, because it was because of the press and the protests. I mean, that war was about helicopters and heroin. It wasn't really about communism. And it was the people that got us into the war. It's too long to explain. Mm-hmm. But, you know, with Israel, basically what happened is you had a... I'm not going to get into the creation of Israel, but basically with the British and the American military support and their yearning for conflict, the whatever peace advocates and peaceful Jews that wanted to, you know, any political clout in Israel never had a chance. That state was a war state from the beginning, because all the hardline Zionist hawks and the most racist, the most, you know, militant bunch got financial support from outside, and from the same thing with religious institutions. It's not your peaceful Quakers that are hurting people. It's the evangelicals that get airtime on TV and rope in billions of dollars and send it to Israel. And so from its inception, it was never going to be a peaceful state, and it never had any political independence. It was inundated with the most militant, the most racist, the most hardline Zionist Jews, Jewish supremacists that were given a country. And obviously that led to conflict, but that was the point, is the more you can get people to fight with their neighbors, the better for the military industrial complex. But I want to get back to the book. It's not that I did this interview just to talk about the book. The whole point is to talk about the book and show its relevance into today. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you're doing a good job on that.
I want to talk about the rapes some, because this is, I hate saying what's worse, whatever, but this is in addition to physically destroying Germany, burning the cities, it's a sort of a spiritual breaking as well when you have mass rape on that scale.
You're absolutely right. It's... To me, to be quite honest, there's a number of terrible components in this book and in the movie that just came out, Hellstorm, the Allied terror bombing we've talked about, the Baltic massacre in which ships went down with 3, 4, even 7 and 9,000 refugees sunk. You've heard of the Lusitania, you've heard of the Titanic. We're talking ships that sink with anywhere from 5 to 7, 8,000 people. Who's counting? They drown. These are nautical disasters like the world has never seen before. Talk about the murder of prisoners, the torture of Germans, common Germans, ordinary Germans after the war. Torture by Americans and by Jewish operators in Poland. Some of the most vicious and beastly tortures the mind could ever imagine. Talking about expulsion, talking about a Morgenthau plan, talking about various components that put them all together. They're called, in my opinion, the world's darkest and best-kept secret. But in my opinion, the rape component is by far the most abominable and hideous and vicious and depraved element in the entire book, in the entire war, in the entire world. Because It's a well, let me give you an example. In fact, much of this occurs on the Eastern Front, where the Russians are invading, not the Russians so much as the Soviets. When I say Russian, there is a Russian ethnic group, Russians, ethnics. This is the Soviet Union, roughly, I think, 15 or 20-something republics, including the Asiatics. On the East Front, as the Russians, the Soviet Union, began to break into Germany, there was an individual, Stalin's right-hand man, a propagandist named Ilya Ehrenberg, a Jewish hate-filled creature who basically made it his job, his duty, to inflame the Soviet soldier as much as he possibly could. And what do I mean by that? I mean by writing these flaming broadsides that were printed into flyers that could be dropped from airplanes onto the front lines so the average Soviet soldier knew what was expected of him. Let me read this to you. This is from one of Ilya Ehrenberg's many flyers. "Kill them all, the old men, the children, and the women, after you have amused yourself with them. Kill. Nothing in Germany is guiltless, neither the living nor the yet unborn. Break the racial pride of the German women. Take her as your legitimate booty. Kill, you brave soldiers of the victorious Soviet army." That's basically an order to the men down below. Once you get into Germany, all bets are off. Everything's free, no laws, nothing. In fact, it's not that you can just do stuff, terrible stuff, for free without consequences. It's demanded of you. It's your duty, as Alexander Solzhenitsyn admitted after the war, the great Russian poet. It was almost a combat distinction to take the women, rape the women, and then kill the women when you were through. And unfortunately, many of these young Soviet soldiers acted upon it and did the most terrible things you can imagine. Now, I had known something about this in the past. Did you have something you want to say, Rye?
I'm saying it's not just raping the women, it's gang raping the women as well.
Yes, I had known something about this in the past. If you read any standard book on World War II, you'll pick up some of this stuff. I had never imagined it, though, to the degree it took place until I started researching. The frontline soldiers were composed largely of Russian ethnics. That is, Russians, Belarus, Ukrainian soldiers, the hard white shock troops. These were the fighters. These are the ones that met the German soldiers and fought tooth and nail on the front lines. The men behind the front line are the Russian soldiers, the second echelon or rear echelon, who brought up the supply side, who drove the trucks, who herded the animals, who cooked, who did lots of things like that. These were the most malicious and vicious and depraved crew you could ever imagine. These also were, by and large, Asiatics. These were Mongols, especially the Mongols, but there were other people from Asia. And these, time and again, the victims, that is the Russian or the German women, talk about the Mongols and the slant eyes and how animal-like they were, running from home to home, from room to room to rape, rape, and rape some more. And this did go on. In fact, throughout the book, rape is a component that appears again and again because it was occurring from 1944 all the way to 1947, the rape component. And yes, probably hundreds of thousands, maybe even millions of German women were raped to death, quite honestly.
Some men raped as well, and boys.
That's been brought up, yes. Although I didn't have any information on that, yes, of course. You have these people that will rape men. But my accounts only are talking about women because, quite honestly, I didn't get the material for that. But of course it did, and you know it did. But you've got these individuals that are not only looting and not only killing, but rape, above all rape. That seems to be their whole reason for existence. And women are actually raped to death, and many of them are killed with a bullet who refuse.
Publicly
and many
raped to death in front of the
public
families.
Rape, and many a child and many a husband is killed because they tried to protect their wife or mother or mother. In fact, one of the special treatments for men who tried to protect their women was to be sawed in half. I don't know what that's all about, but time and again they talk about men folk being sawed in half, literally. But the other devilish component to the rapes that occurred was that they always seemed to be a public affair. It wasn't enough to rape a woman. It seems as though you had to find a public place to rape a woman, either in the town square, in a building filled with people, especially a church. They loved going to churches because there they could rape the nuns over and over and over. And many women chose the church as a refuge, of course, and it was the worst place on earth they could go. Or if it happened to be a farmhouse, a wife, a mother, was raped in front of her family time and time again. And I think the element here that's let me say this, with almost every Russian unit, Soviet Union that came through, you almost always had a Jewish commissar. That's a political officer that is always available, always around to make sure that all the soldiers are good little Soviets and Marxists and communists and hate Germans to the proper degree. In other words, if you don't, you might have your brains blown out by this Jewish commissar. So these characters, these vicious cheerleaders are always there making sure that this happens. And of course, for a woman to be, it's terrible enough for a person, any person, to be raped, even if it's in the privacy of a bedroom or a hidden corner among the rubble. But to be raped and survive your rape in front of your entire village, the village that knows you as perhaps the young 18-year-old who works in the village grocery store selling bread and cheese, it's a double death, because if she survives, she really doesn't. Because let's face it, her spirit, she's been spiritually slaughtered. Her entire village has seen her on her hands and knees being servicing 100 filthy, dirty, drunk Mongolians one afternoon. How do you go back to selling bread and cheese in that store if you survive?
Well, there were areas that the Germans recaptured, and they said what survivors there were not there. They were vacant and just muttering the same sentences and just not, they're completely mentally fucked.
And yeah.
No one could survive such a thing.
You know, it's standard operating procedure. We're not talking about aberrations or anomalies here. We're not talking about something out there. This is standard. This happens over and over again. And here's something else that becomes fairly standard when you see it written enough times, in the words of the people themselves, by the way. Raping a woman in broad daylight on a busy street, over and over, a line standing there raping her until she dies from bleeding, from the vagina, of course, or from the beatings she continually gets. And yet the line continues to build. They keep coming, and they keep laughing, to rape a corpse in broad daylight. When the woman eventually becomes as stiff as a log, then they cram a telephone receiver or an iron bar or a rock up her vagina to signify closed for business. It happens over and over and over again, so much so that it's not something out there. It's not just some aberration.
Corpses, every single one was bloodstained in the crotch region.
Yes, over and over.
Lined up all next to each other with that impaling.
Yes, in fact, I should say this. Maybe it would explain or help one to understand, if not excuse. But the Russian soldier and the Asiatics who followed were crazy for drink, crazy for booze. The war had been fought 2 or 3 years in Russia itself, the Soviet Union, and now suddenly, all bets are off. You can do anything you want. And so getting drunk then and now, quite honestly, I've been in the military myself, is the thing you want to do the most. They would grab anything from perfume and expensive cognac all the way to rubbing alcohol and even gasoline and drink that stuff. So you've got wild animals anyway with hate in their hearts and with sadism in their minds. Now, blitzed, utterly out of their minds with this stuff they've just thrown into them. I guess that's what makes a monster. It makes somebody capable of raping a corpse over and over until it's dead and laughing about it. Now, this, I wouldn't have put that in the book, this aspect, this raping of corpses, and actually going into mortuaries and raping the bodies in there, going into old folks' homes and raping the people. You know, the standard age range, the laughing that they laughed about it was from 8 to 80. Any woman in that age range could expect to be raped and raped some more, raped over and over. But I've found occasions where there were children 6 years old and women 90-something years old actually being raped. So there are no absolutes in this. The borders are situational. But when you have a crew like this of monsters, this is what happens. And you're right.
They have the audacity to have war crimes tribunals, in the Nuremberg trials, and talk about what the Germans did, and a lot of it they did do. They burned villages in Poland, and they did a lot of horrible things, but the Allies were guilty of every single thing they accused the Nazis of doing. They had done, not only in that war, but in other wars before and after, and yet none of them went to jail. None of them we can't even acknowledge that there was a crime and that it even happened. It was like, well, you deserve it because you're Nazis. And not even all of them were Nazis. And
you're right.
They're civilians. It's the same. It's like I hear this tale of people who try and justify nuking Hiroshima and Nagasaki, where they say, well, they attacked Pearl Harbor. I'm like, well, for one, Hawaii was not part of the United States and wouldn't be until 1958. Two, Pearl Harbor was a military base and it was attacked because of the oil embargo and everything. They didn't attack Hawaii. They attacked a base. But when the U.S. got to Japan, they just bombed cities. It didn't matter if there was a base there or not. They were attacking Japan and Japanese people. And the racist propaganda, you know, the monkeys and the dehumanization process that went on, there, you know, of course there was lots of rape and murder and take no prisoner. I mean, that's what it is. And I'm not saying the Japanese didn't rape Koreans or anything either. I mean, of course the Japanese murdered and raped Chinese and Koreans and did the same kind of crime. But they also, that's acknowledged and been punished. But what the Americans did, what the Soviets did, the French, the British, burning people alive, raping, it's like it never happened at all.
You know, Ry, I want to go back. You were talking about, you know, the Germans did some terrible things. Warfare is always bad. I don't give a damn what anybody says. It's always bad. It's always evil. It's always inherently bad and evil. Accept that. People will do bad things. You cannot control all of them. And so, yes, there were excesses and crimes committed by Germans.
Well, they held to the Geneva Conventions better than the Allies.
Absolutely. They adhered to it to the T, as Americans even admitted. 99% of American POWs lived, survived the terrible German POW camps to go back home and mow their lawns, get married, 99%. That's not me talking. That's the International Red Cross. Germans, to the best of their abilities, even in the late stages of this hideous cataclysm called World War II, did their dead level best to live up to the Geneva Convention and the rules of civilized warfare. Also, let me say this. Germans captured roughly 5 million Russian soldiers in the initial stages and later stages of the war. The Soviet Union and Germany had no agreement, no Geneva Convention. There was nothing there. In other words, the Germans were not obligated in one at all to provide the Russian POW with any food, any shelter, any clothing, anything. In fact, the Russians more or less, Soviet Union more or less treated their German prisoners immediately like the slaves that they were, and they were off to the mines if they weren't killed immediately.
The same thing to the other Russians.
Yes, of course. We're talking about Jewish Bolshevism in operation in Russia for the last 30 years. That's what you've got right now. However, I think it's instructive that at the end of the war, there were something like 5 million Russians that survived that war, that lived to go back to Stalin and probably face the Gulag like Alexander Solzhenitsyn did, or perhaps get back to their village, marry Olga, and then, try to live. Now, the Germans...
Well, you know about Operation Keelhaul.
Yes, where, it's in the book also, yes.
Right,
it's,
well, of course, you know, I'm just saying it as a way of segueing, but that's, again, for people who don't know what that is...
They were actually expatriated forcefully.
Right. Were murdered once they got back to the Soviet Union.
They were forced back, and that was another crime. It's a crime. It's a treachery and a deception and a deceit so enormous that I don't know of any other greater than that. And while we're on it, let me just say a couple of things about that. All these Russians and that were either captured or had actually thrown down their arms and went to the German side, Not knowing what's going to happen, probably a POW camp, maybe starvation, maybe death. Nevertheless, preferred that rather than to fight for Stalin and communism. These people, after the war, roughly 5 million. Stalin wants them back. He demands they come back. The Americans and British obeyed. They would have done anything for him. Now, they didn't have to because at the time...
Sorry, folks, I have to cut the recording right there. That is the first hour with Thomas Goodrich, the author of Hellstorm, which is also a movie right now. You can buy Hellstorm on Amazon. You can watch the Hellstorm film on YouTube for free. It's also in the documentary section of ANC Report. We have another segment left, but I'm cutting this in half because of how long it is. And what I'm going to do is throw the whole thing up, password protected on Vimeo for ANC members, people with reoccurring payments on PayPal. As little as a dollar, you can do that. It's worth it. And I will have the rest of it up for everyone else later. It will still go up for free. I'm just giving it to members first. I got to give them something. That's just an unfortunate part of this whole business is we have to make a little bit of money somehow so that we can keep making films and books. We're going to be talking about Eisenhower and Eisenhower's death camps that a lot of people don't know about, and more topics on World War II and the destruction of Germany. He will be back also to talk about the Pacific Theater, and I know a lot about what happened in Japan, and it's unfortunately a lot of the same as Germany and worse in some cases. So, if you're an ANC member, you will have an email with a code to Vimeo, and you can go listen to the rest of this talk with Thomas Goodrich right now. If not, then you can wait a little while and I'll have it up as soon as I can get to it. I appreciate all your support. You keep these programs going. Thank you very much.